I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. I'm joined here with Michael Polignano and Matt Parrott, and we're going to talk about something that I know virtually nothing about, and that is Bitcoin. Bitcoin has popped up over the last few years, and I've been hearing some talk about it. But frankly, guys, it sounds to me like monopoly money or Farmville credits, and I'm counting on you to explain this to me. So, Matt, why don't you take it away first?
Okay, well, some of our listeners out there might have heard Bitcoin in the news if they follow the news especially closely, because it has actually received for the first time really some mainstream media coverage. Most of us have heard about what's been happening in Cyprus, which is what sort of brought Bitcoin into the news and has arguably played a role in Bitcoin's recent spike in value. What happened in Cyprus was they're going through a bailout, they're negotiating with the European Union, you have all that. But during one of the phases of negotiation, they actually proposed to shave a considerable amount off the top of all of the account holders, which caused a bank run, caused a panic, and caused a sort of reverberating panic throughout the entire global economy of, oh no, even private small account holders aren't sacred. As far as like in the United States, we have like FICA. It used to be 10,000. I think it's now 100,000, where that money, even if the bank completely implodes on itself, you're still guaranteed that money. And they just said, oh, well, you know, we kind of overexerted ourselves, and now we're going to take your money. And that's where a lot of people are wondering, how can I have security with this economy, with all these global problems going on, and the government's inflating it? And so a lot of people are turning to Bitcoin as a completely non-governmental alternative to the government fiat financial system.
Okay, so Mike, Matt, what are Bitcoins?
Well, what the Bitcoin is I guess it's been about 5 years ago, relatively recently, a mysterious programmer, Satoshi Nakamoto, which is actually a pseudonym, and the research indicates it's most likely a European fellow, either of English or Irish descent, or a small team in Europe. But they use the sort of this Japanese pseudonym, and it's an open source program. You install it, and if you're mining, which means creating coins, you're creating coins with your program, and then you can trade these fake, I'll just call them fake at this point, coins with other people who've installed the same program. And from there, it sort of works like if some of our users out there, shame on them, use BitTorrent for downloading movies and such. BitTorrent has no central server. There is no central bank with Bitcoin. It's run on this vastly distributed consensus model, where everybody comes to this distributed agreement on how many coins each person has. And the interesting thing there is it actually becomes more fault-tolerant and resilient than a centralized bank. The coins themselves are created with a hashing algorithm. The best way to explain this to the non-technically inclined is that the Bitcoin itself is actually a coded math riddle that's very difficult for computers to process. So the act of generating that is where the value comes in, and deciphering where that Bitcoin came from and such is where the work in the model. Maybe do you think you might be able to boil it down a little better than that, Michael?
Well, the technical details are at a level that I haven't gone to yet as far as going into the code and whatnot, but the hash algorithm is protected with strong cryptography, and that's basically what secures all the transactions that are done on Bitcoin. The only way that any sort of centralized influence could occur is if one person or one group takes over most of the mining power to mine Bitcoins. And right now there are several really large mining collectives, but none is so large to exert that kind of influence. Since there's a finite number of Bitcoins, I believe it's 21 million Bitcoins, there's scarcity. And really the only way that the system could be corrupted is if false transactions are generated and inserted into what's called the blockchain, which is what everybody, all the computers running Bitcoin go through to be able to verify that the transaction is valid.
So mining sounds like a euphemism to me for creating something out of nothing. And the process of creating something out of nothing basically consists of what? Decoding information, trading bits and pieces of information back and forth on a network?
Yeah, the SHA-1 algorithm, I don't want to, there's this funny meme where it's just like science, and there's this picture of a guy who looks crazy, and I guess that's might just be where we have to leave it, but yeah, it's very difficult to decode a SHA-1 algorithm or find a match for a SHA-1 algorithm, and that's sort of what these miners are doing. But earlier you sneered at it saying that it's sort of like Farmville credits, but honestly, that's not fair to Farmville Credit, because Farmville credits are backed by the full faith and credit of the registered multimillion dollar corporation that runs Farmville, whereas there is truly absolutely nothing backing Bitcoin.
Well, what backs Bitcoin is simply the willingness of people to trade them, right?
Right, so, right.
You know, it's a very peculiar notion. What I like about Bitcoin is that it's a pure fiat currency. It just doesn't have any centralized issuer, right? But is it even a currency? It has no physical nature. It does have a digital trail, and it is finite. And so what it strikes me as, it strikes me as a commodity, as a virtual commodity that somebody has willed into existence and now has value. And how much value does each individual Bitcoin have now?
Last I checked, it was $89.
You don't have any Bitcoins hidden under your pillow, do you, Mike?
Yeah, we have no idea how many Bitcoins Mike had, because he'd been in it for years. So he probably bought them whenever they were like 10 cents a coin. If you see any new Ferraris showing up or anything like that, you know, be on the lookout.
No, not quite. I got them when I first started looking into it, really, towards the end of 2010, beginning of 2011, and that's about the time, actually, when I put the PayPal donate button. I thought it might be a good idea to put a little Bitcoin donation option there as well. I don't think anybody ever noticed it, because nobody's really taken Bitcoin seriously until now, but it's there, and I played around with it a little bit, and I think the coins were worth about $5 a Bitcoin at the time,
right,
early 2011. Unfortunately, they kind of came and went. So.
Okay. Well, at least we still have the magic beans, and that's some consolation. The absurdity of the whole thing is very close to the surface here, but it's still something to be taken seriously. It's a remarkable illustration of the nature of social reality or convention, right? That this is real. That this started as simply a file sharing program, creating a virtual commodity with a fixed amount, so it's scarce, and now it's actually trading for real money. And one of the reasons why it's trading for real money, of course, is that the real economy is even shadier than this virtual economy. And that, I think, is a real testimony to how bad off the actual economy is at this point.
Right.
So what do you think the future of Bitcoin is, and are there other virtual currencies and things like that that are being put forward? Do you think this is going to change the way banking and money operate in the world?
Well, I might be the wrong person to ask, because I honestly see this completely toppling the global financial order. Now, what you said about competing currencies or whatever, anybody can download the Bitcoin software and create Bob coins. Bob can download it and start issuing Bob coins. And if somebody accepts Bob coins, now that's where network effect comes in, the theoretical power of the network effect, where Bitcoin was sort of there first and Bitcoin has sort of proven itself to be solid. So it's unlikely, unless another coin comes around, another virtual cryptocurrency comes around, which is dramatically better, that Bitcoin will be replaced. It's kind of like how Facebook even if something came along that was better than Facebook, and Google sort of learned this the hard way, people are so deeply invested psychologically and literally and in their time and in their relationships that you can't just come along and create a better application than Facebook because there's such a deep network effect going on there. And that's what you have with Bitcoin's relative to the other currency. But if you think about what would the ideal currency be, a lot of our listeners out there surely have some gold or silver bullion, and if they've really thought about it, that's not really an ideal currency in a lot of ways. I'm not saying it's not a valuable part of a healthy, balanced portfolio, but how are you going to trade that over distance? How do you divide your bullion? A lot of people have like gold certificates. How do you trust that that person manning the vault, that corporation manning the vault, will, in the case of a catastrophe, even be able to get you your bullion if he wanted to, presuming your bullion's there right now? And these kinds of things, if you think these through, bitcoins are really an ideal currency, except for the fact that they are fiat. A lot of people don't realize that their dollar bills are fiat, that fiat's not really that alien or scary of a concept.
I don't think that a fiat currency really is a scary concept at this point. I think that with Bitcoin, really, I think eventually it'll probably, in the long run, take down the global banking system. That's kind of a big prediction, but you know, I just see how it's been resilient so far. It's had a few speculative bubbles and bursts early on, stuff like that. It's weathered that. It hasn't shown any intrinsic weakness in its code that could compromise it. And so really the only thing it depends on is a functioning internet and functioning basic utilities to be able to access the internet. But if you consider the fact that the internet was created by the U.S. Department of Defense's ARPANET to be resilient, I think it's going to be around for a while. So as long as the internet is up in some part of the world, even if the government did something like they did in Egypt and shut down all of the routers to access the internet, your bitcoins would still have value that you could trade for something else.
Right. You know, we're all praying that the lights are going to go out someday. We're all praying for a big collapse.
Racist rapture.
Yeah, if the big collapse comes and the lights go out, then the internet's going down. Mm-hmm. And we better make sure that we have some real stuff in our portfolio as well as some virtual stuff. But by the same token, if the internet is up and you have a cellular signal or whatever, and you can't get access to your gold and silver, you know, it's buried in the backyard somewhere halfway across the country. As long as you have a smartphone with you, you have things you can trade. And that, I think, might be a really useful little insurance policy. For me, I do not think of gold and silver as investments. I think of them as insurance policies. I don't think that anybody should be buying gold and silver and getting up every morning and looking to see if their gold and silver has gone up or down. I just think that's a terrible waste of time and mental energy. But if you want to have some of this stuff around, whatever the dollar value it has, that can be totally wiped out. There may be no dollars, but there will be some value for gold and silver, and therefore it is an insurance. However, this also strikes me as a scarce virtual commodity that some people will accept. And if people do accept it, then I think it's a good thing to have a little bit of. But on the other hand, as a social credit believer, I don't really think that this is a good currency, and I do not think that this could be a substitute for fiat currency in the more strict state-issued sense. Ideally for me, what I'd like to do is I'd like to have a state of our own, a state that we can trust that looks out for our interests, and that state would issue currency, and it would issue currency in parallel with economic growth, so there's no inflation or deflation, and it would issue currency simply by depositing an equal amount of money in the checking account of every citizen once a month, and that's how currency liquidity would be injected into the economy. And then people could go out and spend their credits however they please, and that would keep the economy functioning. Whereas Bitcoin is a commodity, okay? And it's a limited commodity, and therefore it has the same problem as gold, when gold was the main currency. And that problem is this. At any particular time, the amount of gold available in circulation is finite. And a lot of people would hoard gold or turn it into jewelry or coffins for pharaohs or reliquaries for, you know, parts of the True Cross and that kind of stuff. So a lot of gold goes out of circulation into, you know, jewels and gewgaws. It's buried in tombs. Or today, it's turned into things that have industrial applications. And so a lot of gold is hoarded. A lot of gold is used in non-currency forms. And the amount is fixed. And so what that means is that currency, if it's ultimately denominated in gold, the effect is deflationary. And what deflation does is it's devastating in an economy over the long term. And so if we just had a Bitcoin economy, we would have the same kind of devastating deflationary economy that we had with a strict gold standard. Well, and that's a bad thing. I wouldn't want to have that.
There is a difference between gold and Bitcoin, though, in that gold can be, as you said, put into ornaments and hoarded. It's a physical thing, whereas Bitcoin is just purely digital. So there's no benefit, really, to having it just for show, or its only value really is in the goods and services it can acquire from other people.
I think there are two levels here. First of all, do we even have a choice? My position is no. I think this is going to have a snowball effect where the conventional central banking model is not going to be able to compete, period. So whether or not we want to have this currency, I don't even know if that's a debate to, you know, worth having, whether we want this flood to come over the horizon or not. But that's an interesting question. The other question is, would it be better if we had a virtuous central bank, which I think is, in essence, the simplest way to explain the whole social credit thing, which, anytime you're talking about economic theory, it can easily get overwhelming and there's so much obfuscation and manipulation. But ultimately, I think a good way to describe social credit theory is, what if the central bank was actually looking out for the people? Which I would say, yes, that would probably be better for the people than having this commodity, abstract commodity currency, which I think we can both agree is better than having the control of this in the hands of the global oligarchy and the Jewish elite.
Exactly, exactly. I can agree with that. And in terms of realpolitik, in terms of the present-day situation in the economic realm, I think this thing will stay around because, obviously, it has some flight value. It's a place where people think they can maintain value in the face of confiscation through just outright confiscation as being proposed in Cyprus, or devaluation through inflation. But inflation is not the only disastrous thing that can happen with currency. Deflation is a problem that should be addressed as well. I don't think that Bitcoin will ever be the single currency, and therefore it will never be a deflationary gold standard type situation. But if it were the single currency, it would have that same problem. It could be objected to in the same way.
Well, but if that rate of deflation is utterly predictable, and the Bitcoin itself is almost infinitely divisible, and currency were no longer something that people used as an investment and stuff, it seems to me like you could have an economy that thrives despite its predictable rate of deflation. I think most theorists, when they talk about deflation, they're actually describing sort of a Grapes of Wrath style engineered or botched manipulation of the currency.
Well, another thing that could be done is if it's just an algorithm, right? It's just a computer program. One could just change the program so that the amount of bitcoins in circulation is kept in complete proportion to real economic growth. And in fact, genuine social credit thinking, orthodox social credit thinking, doesn't depend on a centralized bank either. And so in some ways, if you change the Bitcoin algorithm, it might actually be the way of realizing the social credit idea, as long as everybody has a laptop or a smartphone with they can receive these credits as they are generated. Now, as a nationalist, I'm a statist, and I think that the tendency of social credit thinking has been towards a kind of centralized bank model where the state would be the issuer and guarantor of these credits. But it could be automated and decentralized in precisely that way. And in some ways, the internet might be the thing that will solve the calculation problems and the accounting problems that are sort of built in to the orthodox social credit model. So this is really very interesting. And somebody who knows a lot more about social credit and about the nitty-gritty technical details of social credit is probably better able to comment on that. I simply don't know.
I think that it's almost like one of the, I'm not saying it's an evil, but it is like one of the evils released from Pandora's box, and that now it's out there. And really, the only way anybody's going to be able to change the algorithm is to go to every place where it's traded and take power there, basically. You know, I mean, as long as people are using it who are producers of value and accept it as payment, it's going to be there.
Yeah, well, maybe you guys, you two computer guys, Matt and Mike, should get together and create your own algorithm, and you can release, you can create the true social credit currency, which we'll call the Ezra Pound.
It's kind of like trying to replace Facebook, as Matt was saying.
Well,
earlier.
I don't know. It might be cool, and you could put Ezra's picture on every note, which would be kind of an interesting question.
I mean, I could see a scenario where, let's say, 20 years from now, people are running around the street screaming and crying because Greg's deflationary scenario has unraveled. Somebody could propose a non-deflationary alternative, and if that were to pick up momentum, I mean, after all, there was MySpace. It is possible.
Yeah, there was MySpace. There was a MySpace generation, wasn't there?
Yeah, it is possible for the network effect. It's not an iron law, and it can. But I think my point there is Bitcoin would have to be discredited and be understood to be seriously flawed in the eyes of 50.00001% of its supporters for it to break.
Well, if the other thing starts coming up alongside of it, the Ezra Pound, all these canny investors might think, well, you know, even the Bitcoin billionaires might be thinking, well, maybe I should have a few little Ezra Pounds in my portfolio just as a hedge. You know, so these things can come alongside. And then if something happens and people lose faith in Bitcoin, the Ezra Pound can step into the breach. Anyway, it's an appealing fantasy. And since we're dealing with something that's entirely a fantasy, although it works in the real world, I think why not? Just free your mind, and maybe the economy will follow.
Well, it's definitely, there's a lot of exciting stuff to figure out, that's for sure.
The idea of replacing a central bank with an algorithm that can compute everything is appealing because it would be open source and fair and completely transparent. But whether or not it can actually be done is another question.
Well, we know that whatever is happening in the corridors of the central banks that determine the economic policy, it is not transparent.
Right.
We do not know what's going on there. We can only guess at what's happening. And it would be very interesting if we could simply make currency creation something that was a function of a distributed, open source, transparent, auditable, infinitely auditable network. That is really something mind-blowing in its potential. Matt, Mike, how does this affect the metapolitics, the politics, the economics, the prospects of the new right?
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, this is shaping up to be a global currency. And as nationalists, we want to have separate states, and ultimately, there's going to be trade and commerce between states, but it's an interesting question. I haven't really given too much thought as to the implications for a global currency on ethno-nationalism.
I personally think it will help it, because what happens whenever you take away the central banking power, when this algorithm, I guess we're all just assuming Bitcoin's going to take over the world. I'm fine with that. But I'm sure a lot of our listeners out there are skeptical, and I don't want to completely lose them here. But let's go ahead and say that Bitcoin takes over the world. Where will the base of power be? And I think it will be in more organic places. I think people instinctively will look to their tribe, will look to their local churches, will look to their neighborhoods, will look to people who look and act and think like them. I think you're really looking at sort of a Keith Preston-style national anarchist result here. I think not enough people on the new right have really grasped the consequences of this open source stuff, and it's counterintuitive. For example, people think of open source as like, you know, no centralized base of power, you know, and that couldn't be farther from the truth. Linus Torvalds with the Linux project is tongue in cheek called the benevolent dictator of Linux, and he absolutely is. This one single man controls this operating system that's in, you know, a huge percentage of the world's computers and virtually all of the computers that do anything important. And he decides by himself. And the reason he does that is because he has natural authority, autoritas. People trust him. And you have a political power structure that's not based on a corporation. It's not Sun Microsystems saying, hey, we're investing $20 million to take over the Linux open source community. They can't do that for any price because you can't buy the trust of this network of developers. And that's kind of what I see happening here, too. An interesting thing with Linux, I don't want to go too far on a tirade here, but it's fascinating, is the source code management tool that Linux uses wasn't distributed enough. It was too centralized in architecture, which paradoxically, and understanding this paradox, I think is key to understanding how open source is really a new right thing. Paradoxically, he created during a caffeine-addled binge this tool called Git, which completely decentralized and distributed the code development process, which he did that because he was frustrated by his lack of control. And you have these organic networks of control around the development of the Linux operating system, where you have a team of developers over here, a team of developers over here. You have thousands of the world's best developers working on this thing. And you have these organic networks of power, control, influence, and hierarchy that develop totally on their own, and the institutions just get in the way of how humans naturally are. And humans naturally are tribal. Humans naturally are hierarchical. Humans are naturally new right. And I think if we get rid of these central banks, we get rid of a lot of these non-governmental quangos and stuff like that, these IMF and all these organizations and governments, quite frankly, I see a use for the state, but a more lean, tribal, ethnic state for a people. That's my vision of the future.
It's interesting, though. I mean, we kind of be going off of Bitcoin. I don't know if we really want to depart too much from that, but how divisible is this whole tribal anarchist thing? How far does that go? Because at some point, you have to say, okay, my tribe is more than just my immediate family. It's more than my region within the nation or within my original homeland. Say I'm Italian, it's more than just being from Lombardy. So you have to reach out and encompass a larger population, but where do you draw the line there?
Well, in the Bitcoin has this, there's this thing called the Bitcoin over-the-counter, and what it is, it's just an IRC channel. But it's an IRC channel where people are actively bidding, just like on the stock market. Only any dork with a computer can just log in and start, you know, bidding. And you ask yourself, well, can't I just go on there and then rip people off? And there's this thing called the Web of Trust. It's an actual – there's an application that manages it. And you have to start out with small transactions, and eventually this person who's operating entirely under a pseudonym, Dr. Love 5000 or whatever, because 134 people before him had large successful transactions with him, you're willing to be the 135th. And my point there is trust. If everything fell apart tomorrow, who would you trust?
Yeah.
And that's where I think the networks where you're going to have the structure building. I mean, you might have a certain love of Lombardy or whatever, but are those the people you're going to trust in a crisis? Are those the people you can turn to for shelter? And that's where looking if it came over on the radio tomorrow that Washington, D.C. has been nuked and it's massive panic. Where would you go? Who would you be like, oh, my gosh, let's all gather together and figure out what to do next? And that's kind of I think it would build up from that. And I think the new right is closer than any other active political framework in anticipating and understanding how that would develop. I think it'd be racial, it'd be ethnic, you'd have gender. A lot of feminists would radically change their tone in such a case because you need strong men who have a sense of patriarchal obligation, who are actually willing to die for women, and they in turn would behave in a manner worth dying for, and you'd have all these things. We'd return to being human. Mm-hmm. In a way that this artificial system, all these ways to prop up career women and everything like that, that aren't natural. And Lowell women and men, I'm not trying to single anybody out here, but it lulls all of us into an artificial, anti-human, non-human way of interacting.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I think the point I was trying to make was that the conflict between national anarchists and statists, I think, is kind of a moot thing, because I think any collection of people, any tribe that bonds together through this web of trust is going to form some way of implementing their codes, their rules, and there's going to be an agreed upon consensus about the way to act, about what's right and what's wrong. And there's also going to be some kind of hierarchy to enforce people who don't adhere to that and say, well, if you don't agree with us, that's fine, but you can't stay here. Or if you do stay here, we're going to punish you. And that, in essence, is a state.
Oh, I agree. And I'm not going down the rabbit hole of theoretical anarchism. They do have a lot to contribute, but I don't drink anarchism straight. I just dab a little, on my plate. Because the idea that there can be no authority, that there can be no final structure or institution that's the final arbiter of justice and things like that. I know they have a lot of I feel they're very circuitous answers to all those questions, and a lot of them sort of arrive back to, there's a funny Simpsons sketch that's coming to mind, but you're going to have police officers, whatever you want to call them, if you want to have them not technically government or whatever, but you're going to have some kind of governing something or other.
There will be somebody who has the power to decide. And that's really what sovereignty is in the political
right. sense. Right, and this isn't – this kind of distributed that goes back to Linus Torvalds. He is very much a dictator. And his only bounds, if you look at the project, if the nonprofit organization that runs Linux were to say, we just fired Linus, they would be the ones to disappear because he has the authority. Now, if Linus were like – okay, I've decided to make Linux Microsoft Linux, and it's now going to be closed source, and we're going to be doing some cool stuff that's completely a departure from the philosophy of then people would leave Linus because he embodies that ideal. And I think that unity of authority and ideal is where real power should come from in an actual political context.
Right, right. It's not just the guy, but it's how well the guy instantiates some higher principle.
Exactly. I keep going back on the open source community because it's kind of like this way to look at politics and governance, which is completely divorced from all of the static and obfuscation and confusion of looking at real politics, which is often too sensitive and close to home.
Right. Are you familiar with John Robb's Global Guerrillas and his Resilient Communities website?
Yes.
John Robb is the first guy that I heard of Bitcoin from, and it fits in very well with his overall worldview. I think that Robb makes, and I've been meaning to write a review of his Global Guerrillas book, or his Brave New War book. It's called Brave New War for a long time because it's enormously pregnant with possibilities for the new right. But his point is that, you know, in a world where you have things like open source terrorist insurgencies, things like that, the state is going to become less and less powerful. And what's going to happen is there will be a contra force to globalization, which is localization, and you're going to have small communities that trust each other. And, of course, he's kind of cagey about how these communities are going to form, but I think the natural way that they're going to form is they're going to form on racial and ethnic and religious lines, all these horrible reactionary things that the one-world globalist types are wanting to erase. So I think that what he has to say is very, very consistent with the sorts of concerns that we have. And so you think that things like Bitcoin are consistent in the same way, basically, that once what happens is these global power structures, these elite-dominated global power structures that are centered in banks and NGOs and states, when these powers break down, to the power to control the economies of the world breaks down through these open source networks, what's going to happen is that real sovereignty is going to devolve to smaller organic communities.
Precisely.
I think so too. I think a big question is how to accomplish that with an absolute minimum of violence, because history shows that when these sorts of power changes occur, there are conflicts and terrible periods of war. And I think one way of minimizing that is getting the understanding out ahead of time as things are starting to decline, but before the shit is totally hit the fan, getting these ideas out and promoting the sort of world that we want to see.
This really reminds me of my review that I did of Patrick Buchanan's Suicide of a Superpower, where at the beginning I said that the biggest fear that I have is really from the right now, and it's from people like Buchanan, and it's from people like Buchanan who might possibly convince these systems that exist to pull pull themselves off the path to perdition and maybe have an Indian summer of some kind of dictatorial Caesarism before they dissolve. Because I think that is really the great fear, that if there is a breakdown in the existing system, that what people will be willing to try, and this sounds really odd from a fascist like myself, but I do not want to see some kind of right-wing dictatorship pop up if the sole purpose of that right-wing dictatorship is to put the anti-white, anti-racial globalist system that exists today on firmer footing. It's as stupid as the Paultards who are trying to make sure that there's sound money for the brown people who replace us. I do not want this existing system to be saved, and I certainly don't want it to be saved by some kind of reactionary dictatorship that doesn't really change the fundamental ethnocidal dynamics that the system has in play. Whereas I look at this kind of global dissolution of power structures as, you know, a potentially very frightening thing, but actually as something that if we can just maintain our cool and if we can make sure that we do whatever we can to prevent that kind of grasp for some kind of Caesar who's going to hold it all together for an Indian summer, then I think that we really can see our way through into something that really is fundamentally different and that does lead to a resurgence of organic communities and organic authority. And I think that's what we really want to see in the world.
Well, I think if the global order is smarter than I give it credit for, what it would do, in my opinion, is go for sort of a Breivik-style Christian West and the Jews against Islam all-out war. And these positions, which have currently been marginalized, like the counter-jihad, far-right wing thing, sort of a WorldNet Daily style, that would shift to the center. Which I'm with you, that sort of civic nationalism and patriotard right-wingism is, I think, our only credible opponent. I think with this left-wing thing, we're just sort of waiting for them to die. Maybe that's very optimistic on my part, but I really think fundamentally they're on such weak footing, and they really are their ideals, the limits of their concepts. Everybody, you know, completely sexually liberated themselves. They got herpes and AIDS, and they've been, you know, picking their blisters for decades now. It's exhausted. you know, where do they go from here?
Right. They go into the great night is where they go.
Right.
But, you know, they're going to hold on for a long, long time. All these boomers are going to be, you know, boomers are they're really the whiners now. They're the old self-indulgent whiners who are going to be clinging to life with the white knuckles until they're finally disconnected from their machines by the Filipinos and blacks and Mexicans that they've handed the country over to. So they're not going to go anytime soon, but you know, and they'll try and drag us down with them. But yeah, I think that their vision really is exhausted. They really do think, though, and this is the great folly of the white liberal left, is that their values were going to triumph once they replaced the white working class and white business people and their white enemies with people from the third world who, historically speaking, have had no use for white liberal values at all, period.
Right.
So I think that their vision is self-destroying. The only question is, will they destroy us before they destroy themselves? I suspect that they'll destroy themselves before they destroy us.
Well, I mean, we call ourselves reactionary, but I mean, they're, in my opinion, they're the ultimate reactionaries. I mean, where would Madonna be without traditional Catholicism to tear down? You know, Britney Spears has to dress up as a Catholic schoolgirl and then debauch herself for the whole thing to work. And you see this across the board. They can't exist without us to rail against because they've entirely defined themselves against tradition in all of its forms and incarnations.
Yeah, for progress, for these Enlightenment era notions of universal equality and egalitarianism, which will never amount to anything. I mean, that's kind of the direction they're heading in. I don't label myself a reactionary because I think that we don't need to return to the past as it was, but we need to take what was true from the past and incorporate those principles into something new and forward-looking. And, for instance, I really am for technology. I mean, Bitcoin is one instance of a technology I think serves our interests. And if we can have the Ezra Pound come into existence down the road, I think so much the better.
By the way, Kevin Strom was the guy who coined the idea of calling the social credit currency the Ezra Pound. I must give him credit for that. I'm not a reactionary either. What I am is a believer in nature. And I think that if we clear away the impediments, that nature will reassert itself and that values that are associated with the past, because they're the values that are vital and will persist in time and give rise to institutions and customs and practices that persist over time, that those vital archaic values will come back. So we don't need to go back to the past, but what we do need is we need to create a space, clear away the impediments, to allow the values that created the greatness of our past to return into the present, and I think that that's what will carry us into the future.
Well, I think that's an excellent summary of the entire New Right perspective, and it's perhaps at least as opposed to conventional conservatism as it is to conventional liberalism.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah.
I think what we should do next is we should schedule a discussion about liberalism, conservatism, and the New Right, because I think that that's a very pregnant topic to discuss. Mm-hmm. And what we should do now is segue to a close for this discussion, because we've been talking for about an hour now. Mike, any last thoughts on this?
Well, I think that timeline-wise, I would give the global banking system maybe 10 years or so. Now, we'll see how that prediction pans out, but I think given the rise in just 5 years of Bitcoin and its resiliency, what it's weathered so far, and given the meltdown in Europe and Cyprus and Greece and so on and so on, I think that we're going to see something within 10 years.
That's really interesting. I forget who did this. I forget who said this, but it was floated on the web. One thing that Ellen Brown, the public banking advocate, suggested that I thought was a really gutsy idea for Golden Dawn is for Golden Dawn to start issuing their own currency. They want to reassert Greece's national identity and take control of Greece's destiny from the central bankers, issue their own currency. And if people don't take it at their shops, well, they can send a few toughs out to break their windows. I mean, it's crude, but the point is that is something that could be done.
More crude than how it works with the dollar. If you try to print your own dollars,
they send people to break your windows and haul you away. Or if you're a sovereign nation, they'll find up some excuse to invade and destroy you. There's no question about that. So yes, exactly. So I think that that's really a fascinating possibility. I mean, something like Bitcoin, something like resurgent national currencies within the Eurozone, as ways that alternative rising political powers, political parties can become real powers. I mean, what if you just say, okay, we're going to start putting out our own currency now, the drachma. We're going back to the drachma, the Golden Dawn drachma. I bet 20, then 40, then 60% of people in Greece would start trading with that currency, and at a certain point, they'll reach a tipping point. That could really be a game changer in terms of reasserting national sovereignty. But then these non-central bank controlled things can also do that. And so the existing system could be crushed within the pincers of global non-controlled currencies and resurgent local currencies that are not being issued by the state, but by people who are credible representations of the people's interests, like a nationalist party. That would be a pincer movement that I think could really bring the current system down. It's worth speculating about. And again, it's all a fantasy anyway. Matt, do you have some last thoughts?
Well, it's all a fantasy, and there are wild predictions here, but that's what you get with the New Right. You get a lot of bold ideas, and we're all just scratchboarding here. But yeah, I think one thing, listeners out there who might not be on board yet, we've been right in the past more than the other people you're listening to. Michael Polignano had the Bitcoins on here years before you heard about Bitcoins. And things like you read in your local paper or whatever, oh, Detroit's reorganizing themselves. There's hope for Detroit. We say no. Detroit will only continue to get worse, and it will continue going bankrupt, and none of the current things that they're doing there will work. I predict that Japan will continue having a relatively stable, successful community, and I think when you look at the overall picture, we have a better track record than any other voice in the American political arena of accurately predicting what's coming. And the reason we can prediction is the ultimate scientific tool of knowing whether your theory is right. If it can predict future behavior, then you're closer to the truth. And we don't always get it right because we're not, you know, always 100% know what we're talking about. But I think if people would give us a chance and go back 5 years and read what we're saying is going to happen and what the competitors, you know, and these other paleocon and conservative magazines and such are saying what's happening, I think you'll be convinced that if you want to know what the future is going to look like, I think we're the perhaps the most credible source.
Well, I would agree with that.
Yeah, it's well said.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you very much. I've really enjoyed this conversation, and we will be definitely doing more roundtables like this in the future. So stay tuned for more episodes of Countercurrents Radio.